This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
You can see that our investments are transparent, they're clean. We don't impose debt burdens that nations can't resolve.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo when asked to compare U.S. investments with Chinese projects. Details coming up. Also, South Africa is experiencing serious water shortages, and a popular Rwandan gospel musician found guilty of conspiracy against the government was found dead in a police cell in the capital, Kigali. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Angolan President João Lourenço in Luanda today, with talks focused on strengthening economic ties and supporting Angolans in their fight against corruption. It was the second stop on a three-nation African visit that already has taken him to Senegal. He is heading now to Ethiopia. VOA Cindy Sain is traveling with him and has this report.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and his wife Susan Pompeo arrived to a very warm welcome in Senegal. One of the events they went to was a meeting with young entrepreneurs, women entrepreneurs, who showed their beautiful clothing and purses and other products. The secretary asked them how far along their businesses were, and he also had official talks with joint partnerships and talking about security with Senegalese leaders, with them expressing concern about increasing terrorism.
Senegal should know that collectively, Senegalese forces in the region, European partners, French, United States, America, we have an obligation to get security right here in the region. It's what will permit economic growth, and we're determined to do that. And I'm convinced that when our review is done, we'll have a conversation with not just Senegal, but all the countries in the region. We'll talk through why we're doing, how we're doing it, we'll deliver an outcome that works for all of us.
For his part, the Senegalese Foreign Minister, Amadou Ba, also said that they really want the U.S. to remain engaged in Africa. That's of critical importance.
We talked about the U.S. presence in the region, and we wish for them to stay, for them to continue helping with security. We want the Americans to continue to help us with training and information.
After Senegal, Secretary Pompeo went to Angola, where he praised President Lourenço for his fight against corruption and said that the U.S. wanted to assist Angola.
We talked first about moving beyond the corruption that stunted this nation's vast potential for far too long. During his first 2.5 years in office, President Lourenço has done great work to make it a ghost of the past. He's increased transparency. He's helped financial institutions clean up their books. And he's pursued bad actors. I'm optimistic that he will continue to liberate Angola from corruption.
At a joint press availability, Secretary Pompeo was asked about U.S. and China competing in Angola and elsewhere. And he was asked to compare the two models. And he said, well, he would leave that to others. But he said, I can tell you, when American companies come into a country, they bring jobs.
You can see that our investments are transparent, they're clean. We don't impose debt burdens that nations can't resolve.
From here, Secretary of State Pompeo will be traveling on to Ethiopia and then to Saudi Arabia and Oman on a long 9-day tour. So from Luanda, this is Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The head of the UN mission in South Sudan is welcoming President Salva Kiir's proposal to return the country to the original 10 state plus 3 administrative areas. The UNMISS chief called it an important compromise so that a unity government can be formed on time, as the warring parties promised the people of South Sudan. La Suba Memo has this report from Juba.
David Shearer, a special representative to the UN Secretary General to South Sudan, is urging the parties to the peace deal to form a transitional government and work together to make a decision on the right number of states, administrative areas, and boundaries. The army's boss says forming an inclusive transitional government by the agreed-to deadline will inspire greater trust and confidence among citizens that the peace process will succeed.
We urge all parties to reach out and embrace each other's positions so that the peace deal can be fully implemented.
After the president's announcement on Saturday, residents of Rang town in Upper Nile State, an area that borders Sudan State, protest against Kiir's compromise offer. Shearer called on all those opposing the decision to accept it for the sake of the country.
It may not be the preferred option of some people. However, they should also recognize it has been done in the spirit of compromise to secure durable peace for the whole country.
Shearer says if Kiir's compromise offer is quickly accepted by all parties, including the SPLM-IO, the transitional government can be formed, paving the way for elections in 3 years' time.
This will enable the people of South Sudan to fully participate in the democratic process. It's a right they've been looking forward to exercising since they won their independence 9 years ago.
The army's chief notes that failure by the parties to meet past deadlines to form a unity government caused dissolution among South Sudanese. Ismail Wise, IGAD's special envoy to South Sudan, is praising Kiir's proposal. Wise said in a statement, this is pivotal in the formation of the revitalized transitional government of national unity and our quest for lasting peace for the Republic of South Sudan. He is urging the parties to work together in good faith and a spirit of compromise in the few days remaining before this weekend's deadline. Speaking to reporters in Juba today, SPLM-IO spokesperson Manawa Peter Gatkwoth said he is optimistic that Kiir and SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar will resolve all the outstanding issues soon. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
Officials in Burkina Faso today said gunmen killed 24 people, including a pastor, in an attack on a church during Sunday Mass. The attackers also kidnapped several people. It was not yet clear who was responsible for the attack yesterday in Pansi in Yaga province in the country's northwest. Extremist militants with links to the Al-Qaeda and Islamic State have been fighting for control over rural Burkina Faso. They have frequently attacked churches and members of the clergy, but many Muslims have also been killed by armed groups. South Africa is experiencing serious water shortages that affect humans and animals in urban and rural areas alike. As Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, experts have warned that these are the result of climate change that will need the country and its neighbors to stop relying on dwindling rainfall and explore new technologies of getting water.
The death of 8-year-old Musambele revealed the reality of climate change. Mbele drowned in a river in Free State Province while trying to fetch water. His township had a water shortage for more than 5 years. The government's solution, bringing in water tanks to mitigate the shortage, has angered residents who are demanding nothing less than water in their taps. Stembile Muloi, a local resident, says they can no longer bear with the suffering anymore.
Our struggle is only about water, nothing else. More than 10 years, we struggled for water. Nothing is coming out from our taps till now. There is no way we can go to work. There is no way anything can work properly without water.
Dr. Balegile Mzangwa, CEO at the Monapo Hospital, says the shortage has become a big inconvenience.
The issue of water, I think, is one of the challenges that we have around here. We cannot get water. Go to go and fetch water from the Jojos.
Warning bells have also been sounded in big cities like Johannesburg, where residents have been warned to use water sparingly. In provinces like the Northern Cape and the Eastern Cape, the drought has been more severe. Imtiaz Suleiman, founder of the humanitarian organization The Gift of Givers, says it's providing water tanks to both people and livestock, but it's clear it cannot meet the demand.
Orphans, young people, old people, disabled, walk kilometers to come to water. Hospitals are shutting down, schools are shutting down, clinics are shutting down. All the things that are for the prosperity of the country are shutting down simply because there's no water.
The government admits the country is facing the reality of climate change and that the solutions will dig deep into finances. Lindwe Sisulu is the Minister of Water and Sanitation.
The recent drought since 2014, which has been carrying on since 2014, that devastated most of the parts of the country, has highlighted the need for a more elaborate facility that can be applied to consistently guide management of water supply and mitigation against risks due to drought.
Experts are urging the government to invest in research and technologies that will provide alternative water and reduce the reliance on natural rain. Patrick Hlabela is a senior researcher at the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research.
We can take advantage of the fact that we have got underground water that we need to access. We have a lot of water that is trapped in pollution. What are we doing about that? We can actually store water for future use. And there are other treatment technologies that are available to treat our domestic wastewater to a quality that can be used.
The government estimates that it would cost about $134 million to fix the current water challenges countrywide. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Kizito Mihigo, a popular Rwandan gospel musician who in 2015 was found guilty of conspiracy to murder or harm President Paul Kagame, was found dead in a police cell today in the capital Kigali, according to a report by the Associated Press. Described by many as Rwanda's biggest cultural icon and a devout Catholic known for songs promoting healing and forgiveness, Mihigo had been pardoned in 2018 but was rearrested last week. An ethnic Tutsi survivor of the 1994 genocide, a police statement said Mihigo killed himself. The official account of a suicide was expected to be met with skepticism in a country where the government is frequently accused of targeting perceived critics. Louis Mudge with Human Rights Watch says, too often, sensitive cases in Rwanda result in mysterious deaths or disappearances. Police asserted that he had been trying to flee to neighboring Burundi to join groups fighting the Rwandan government. Police said Mihigo had been allowed to meet family members and his lawyer. It was not immediately known whether he had been in a solitary cell. According to a new report from a coalition of Kenyan human rights groups, Kenyan police last year killed 107 people. Most of those killed were young men, mostly from slum areas, also called informal settlements. The report captures victims' stories and lays out demands to Kenyan authorities to make the killings stop. Rael Ombor reports.
The new report was compiled by Missing Voices, a coalition of at least a dozen rights groups in Kenya. For the release of the report Friday, the group held a protest on a busy commuter street in Nairobi that was attended by dozens of bereaved mothers who have lost children and spouses at the hands of police. Rene Ngamau of rights group Amnesty International laid out some of the statistics.
69% of those who were killed were youth between the ages of 18 and 35. 20% were below the ages of 18 years of age. That's to say, children. 80% of those who were killed in 2019 are below the age of 35. We're criminalizing youth. We're criminalizing poor youth.
Wanja, who asked to be identified by her first name only, told VOA that police killed her only son late last year in Madari, an informal settlement in Nairobi. She discovered her son in the streets minutes after he was shot.
Waliuliwa wakiwa vijana wawili. Sasa mimi wakati nilikuwa nenda kunywa maziwa, nikapata duka imefungwa, nikasema acha
nitoke. I saw two boys lying on the ground, she says. My boy was on the left, the other one on the right. She says she identified her son by the jacket he had worn. When I approached them, the police cocked the gun at me. She says she ran home and told her nephew, I think my Alex is dead. Javan Ofula, a human rights activist, said researchers could not find good cause for many of these shootings.
These people have been killed through the documentations that have been done in different spaces. Some of them have been seen to be killed in circumstances that are not really holding water. They were not resisting arrest.
Anne Makori is the chairperson of the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, Kenya's police accountability institution. She said out of 160 cases of police killings referred to IPOA in 2019, investigations have been concluded in only 9 cases. 6 have been forwarded to the Office of Public Prosecutions. The rights groups are demanding reparations for victims and families of extrajudicial killings and want the Inspector General of Police to admit extrajudicial killings are a problem that must be stopped. The groups also want implementation of the National Coroners and the Prevention of Torture Acts passed in 2017. Makori said IPOA would like to see this too.
About the Coroners Act, yes, is an issue of concern for us as IPOA, because we know the act is in existence, but a coroner has not been appointed, and therefore it becomes a little difficult to operationalize the act. And same with the Prevention of Torture Act. Those are areas we have not only discussed with the civil society, but we've also raised concerns within the government structures.
VOA reached out to Kenya Police for this story, but the police declined to comment. In 2018, the then police spokesman Eric Kiraide said it is a fact that suspects have died while in contact with the police, but he said each killing should be dealt with individually and the outcome of each case should be determined on its own merits. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Meanwhile, in Kenya's northeast Boni Forest on the border with Somalia, schools that were closed for 5 years after attacks by militant group Al-Shabaab have reopened. But many children are still unable to attend classes, as few teachers are willing to work in the area. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Kiangwe, Kenya.
This is the first time since 2015 the children of Boni Forest are attending school, since attacks by Al-Shabaab prompted most teachers to flee the area, fearing for their lives. Farik Sadiq is one of 10 educators who have taken the challenge to teach in one of the 5 reopened schools this year.
We feel there's something to be done to the community, because we were trained as teachers and we were trained to work anywhere in the republic.
Kiangwe village is the gateway to Boni Forest, from where Al-Shabaab launched deadly attacks in 2015 that forced area schools to close. Kiangwe Primary School was among 5 that shut their doors. Since then, local children have been homeschooled or travelled long distances to receive an education. Some receive no education at all. Lamu County Commissioner Irungu Masharia told VOA that local officials are doing everything to keep Boni children in school.
We have greatly improved the security. We have also deployed teachers in those schools. We have a head teacher and a classroom teacher. We have ECD teachers in those schools. So the schools are running normally. We have also provided resources, books and everything.
But while Kiangwe Primary School resumed classes, authorities say the fear of more attacks means few teachers are willing to return. Mohamed Abuli is on the school committee.
Shule.
There were issues of insecurity in our school. We enhanced security, but we don't have enough teachers, he says. There's only one teacher, but so many students. There still are not enough instructors to teach the upper grades, forcing some students to stay at home. Zainab Bakari says her teenage son has nowhere to go to advance his education. Here we have got school only up to 4th grade, she says. I don't have the fare to send him out. It is my loss. I am at a loss, she says. Bakari and other families can only hope the improved security will attract more teachers so all the children can get back to school after such a long break. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Kiangwe, Kenya.
Thank you. Zimbabwe has officially joined the African Continental Free Trade Area despite outstanding economic issues in a move that is raising concerns over its timing. Adigando gives us more on the story.
At the recent African Union AU summit in Addis Ababa, President Emmerson Mnangagwa announced that Zimbabwe is fully joining the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. Last year, Zimbabwe ratified the agreement but stopped short of agreeing to fully implementing it, saying the country would only come on board when it is seen to have fully industrialized. 27 African Union member states have implemented the African Continental Free Trade Agreement in the past year. It is expected to grow intra-African trade in what the AU contends will be a continent-wide market of 1.2 billion people worth US $2.5 trillion. The United Nations Economic Commission for Africa, UNECA, projects that intra-African trade will increase by 52% by 2022 compared with 2010 levels. Zimbabwe is among six countries, alongside Ethiopia, Madagascar, Malawi, Sudan, and Zambia, that support the ACFTA, but argue they face specific development challenges barring full membership. The Confederation of Zimbabwe Industries estimates that the country's manufacturing capacity utilization stands at 34.6%. Some economists and analysts say Mnangagwa's announcement is premature. Economic analyst Thomas Stole is among them.
The decision has been motivated by political expedience, where we want to be seen as a country that is encouraging regional integration. But it also presents serious challenges. If you look at the free movement of people, if you look at Boko Haram and other groups like Al-Shabaab, they can easily seek refuge in an environment where there are no strict adherence to controls and checks and balances.
So they say the country stands to benefit little by implementing now.
Given the fact that our industrial base, our manufacturing sector is non-existent at the moment, so what we're most likely going to see is a flood of goods from other countries at the expense of the local industry. The government would have worked on a program where they capacitate the local industry to a level where we are able to export to the region and to the rest of Africa. That way, then we can embrace this free trade agreement and also benefit.
Economic analyst Dumisani Sbanda agrees with Stole. He notes an incident in which chickens from Brazil were shipped to Zimbabwe via South Africa. South Africa utilized its bilateral trade agreements with both Brazil and Zimbabwe to import and export the chickens in a move analysts say violates the spirit of the rule of origin, exempting tariffs for locally manufactured goods.
The problem that we are facing is that production is oppressed, agriculture is oppressed, the economy is very fragile.
Under the trade pact, governments commit to removing tariffs on 90% of goods produced on the continent. Business experts and economists say Zimbabwe and other countries with weak economies may experience a glut of foreign goods, which will cause further harm if few jobs remaining are exported. Sibanda thinks the country is in bad shape.
We still require trade area tariffs to give the domestic industry an opportunity to recover. And because our institutions are weak, even in terms of regulating the free trade area, the institutions are still not that strong.
A United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, studied 2 years ago, said the trade agreement offers many opportunities for sustainable development and economic growth in the African economies. But not all countries will benefit to the same extent and at the same time. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.